Let's do a little bit of meditation again on the idea of a self-sufficient, substantially existent self or I, which we have an innate inborn conception that there is such a self. And so we have within our experience from the time we're born and in all our past lives, this this notion and this tendency to grasp at such a self. So bring to mind an experience in which you had some afflictive emotion. It could have been anger or irritation or fear or anxiety, desire or depression, jealousy or arrogance. So any afflictive emotion that came up in a strong way. So try to bring that experience to mind as clearly and vividly as you can. And so when you've remembered this experience, put aside the emotion for now and focus on the sense of I that lies behind or beneath that emotion. The I that feels angry or jealous or anxious or whatever. I'm trying to catch a glimpse of that eye. And see if you can understand how it seems to exist. Does it seem to be something that's just imputed in dependence on the aggregates, the body and the mind? Or does it seem to be something that's kind of separate from the body and mind, able to appear on its own without the need for any part of the body or mind to appear? Does it seem to be something that seems to be in charge of the body and the mind, their owner and boss? So if the I does seem to exist in this way, as something kind of powerful and independent on its own, then the more carefully we examine it, the more clear it should become, and the more convinced we should be in its existence. So like if we see a mirage on the surface of the desert or an asphalt road or parking lot, and if we want to check if it really is water as it appears to be, then we should be able to go right up to it And the closer we get, the more clear it should be that it's water. If it is water, we should even be able to get right up to it and touch it and then be convinced, yeah, it really is water. But if it's a mirage, then the closer we get, the more uncertain we are that it's really water. And finally, the appearance of water disappears altogether. And we realize it was only a mirage. So see if you can take that kind of approach with this seemingly real, independent eye. Try to get closer to it and see what happens. If getting closer to it makes you more convinced that it's real, it really exists, or do you become less convinced and it seems to be something more insubstantial, more implausible? So if you find that kind of exercise difficult to do, don't worry, it is difficult. Because the eye, sense of eye, can be so slippery, seems so strong when we're not looking at it or looking for it. But then when we do try to look for it, it can kind of slip away, sneak away. But just trying to do this is so good. You know, just this exercise of checking the eye, what is it? How does it exist? It undermines the strength of the sense of eye, you know, the strong sense of a real eye that underlies all our experiences. So just questioning that, starting to question that, is already very helpful. Okay, so to continue. Well, Chinny's not here. All right. That's right. Because I prepared this first slide in response to a question that she brought up last week.
I'll send her the recording. I'll send her the recording. I think she's focusing on her IG stuff.
Okay. Anyway, so last time, I had shared some information from Study Buddhism, which is the website, Alex Berzin's website, which is like a treasury of all kinds of interesting information. And so what I shared last week was how the non-Geluk schools, like Kagyu, Nyingma, Sakya, and they have different some differences in the way they explain Madhyamaka. For example, that the Madhyamaka schools assert 8 consciousnesses. And this is different from what I had always heard. And yeah, according to Galupa, the Galupa explanation of Madhyamaka, Madhyamaka doesn't accept 8 consciousnesses, only the usual 6. But the non-Galupa schools say otherwise. So that was one example. And so then Vemochuni asked, well, what do they say about external objects? What do the non-Galuppa schools say that Madhyamaka says about external objects, external existence? Since if they say there's eight consciousnesses, does that mean they also say that there's no external existence? So anyway, I was I went back to study Buddhism, and I found an article on, it was called, I think, the Galuk Understanding of Svatantrika. And yeah, so what's on the slide is from that article. So the first point says Galupa school says that Svatantrika accepts external objects, and Yogacara Svatantrika rejects them. So that's what I've always learned. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because Svatantrika Svatantrika is like Svatantrika, and they say, yes, there's external existence, external objects, but Yogacara Svatantrika is like Yogacara, and they say, no, there's no external objects. So, yeah, so that's the Galuk view. And then, so on this article, it says, the non-Galuk, that's the second bullet point, non-Galuk, all Madhyamaka schools accept external objects. So I was very surprised by that, and I wrote to Alex, because I said, but what about like the ornament for clear realizations, which I'm teaching some topics from that in the Wednesday night class. So that text and its commentaries are supposedly from the point of view of the Yogacara Svatantrika, and they say that there's no external objects. That's very clear. What do the non-Galuk schools say about that? How can they say Yogacara accepts external objects? Are you following me? Mm-hmm. This is a little complicated, but anyway. And so he sent a reply, and he said that this article that I was reading on his website, called The Galuk Understanding of Svatantrika, he said, this is from a lecture that he gave almost 20 years ago, and it oversimplifies and overgeneralizes. And that he said, I would explain much differently if I were to answer that question now, but I am on vacation at the moment, and I don't have access to all my reference books, so I can't refine fully what I said then. Yeah, so he wasn't able to give a complete explanation. It's a lot more complex than that. But he still wrote a few more paragraphs after that, much of which I didn't understand. But one of the things he said was, it all depends on how you define and describe external existence. Okay, and then he went on to talk about how he mentioned the true aspectarians and the false aspectarians, remember them? And you know how they have differences in the way they explain, you know, things that appear to us. So it's got something to do with that. and he did confirm in his email, he did say Yogacara Svatantrika accepts the point about no externally established existence. You know, like before we see something, that object is there. Okay, they do reject that. But then he went on to say, but being Madhyamaka, this school also brings in mental labeling in conjunction with the findable defining characteristic on the side of the object. So my guess, what he meant by that was that the Yogacara Svatantrika, they do refute external objects, just like the Chittamatra does, but not in the same way as Chittamatra. Because remember, Chittamatra says things are truly existing, whereas Yogacara doesn't. Yogacara Svatantrika doesn't. So a lot of complexities there. So what I got from his reply was, yeah, it's very complex. And he wasn't in a position at this moment to give a full explanation. But anyway, just we can put that on hold for now. Maybe he'll write more later. But then this last bullet point, I wanted to mention that as well, because this was in his article. It says, the non-Galukh schools don't clearly differentiate, SSM means Sotrantika, Svatantrika, Madhyamaka, and Yogacara, Svatantrika, Madhyamaka, as Lama Tsongkhapa does. Okay, so there's also differences in how they talk about those schools, even if they do, if they even do talk about them, that may not be clear. And this is interesting, he said, and they say that Madhyamaka assertions are all Svatantrika assertions because Prasangika doesn't assert anything. And this rang a bell, because I've heard that before. And the idea is, in at least one of Nagarjuna's texts, the refutation of objections, in one verse he says, I have no thesis. And also Chandrakirti, I looked up in his text, because I remember studying this, in his supplement to the Middle Way or Entering the Middle Way, he also says the same thing. I have no thesis. And so it seems that, Lama Tsongkhapa, the way he interprets those statements by Nagarjuna and Chandrakirti, what they mean is they have no inherently existing thesis. I have no thesis that is supporting inherent existence. That's what they mean, according to Lama Tsongkhapa. But it seems maybe these other schools take those statements literally and think, yeah, Nagarjuna and Chandrakirti, they don't have any assertions of their own. I mean, they said that. They said it right here. So I thought that was interesting. And so I don't fully understand what they mean, but you know what that means, but it's an interesting idea. Prasangika doesn't have any theses, doesn't assert anything. So whatever assertions there are, they're all Svatantrikas. So anyway, I just wanted to share that interesting idea.
In one of Jay Garfield's books, he also says that the consequentialists don't assert anything. In their engaging Buddhism.
Yeah. Well, Lama Tsongkhapa, it's actually in the Lamrim Chenmo, Lama Tsongkhapa talks about this and explains, you know, how to interpret that, what that means. He said it's very clear that Madhyamikas do assert things. They assert dependent arising, conventional existence, and they assert no inherent existence. So they do definitely make assertions. So we can't take that kind of statement literally. Anyway, I'm not in a position to say one way or the other, but this is Lama Tsongkhapa's view. But in this article, it was actually a lecture that Alex was giving, and he talked about how when he first started studying Tibetan Buddhism, he would get quite confused because different teachers would say different things. And, you know, and even within Galupa, within one school, there's many different colleges, like Sara and Ganden and Drepung. And within those, there's colleges, and each college has their own textbooks, and the textbooks don't always say the same things. And so for him it was very confusing. And this reminded me also when I was, you know, in the early days studying Buddhist philosophy, and I'd sometimes get kind of frustrated because the teacher would be saying, oh, so-and-so says this and so-and-so says that. And I'd be sitting there thinking, I don't want to hear what these different scholars say. I just want the right answer. Just tell me, what is the right answer? you've probably heard Venerable Children talk about that as well. Yeah. You know, we have this idea there's got to be one right answer, one truth. And I just wanted that. And then I'd write that down in my notebook and I'd learn it and I'd say, okay, now I know the right answer. This is how it is. So I think it's kind of maybe a kind of laziness, you know, just wanting the answer and not wanting to think and investigate for yourself. And so Alex says it's actually good that there are different opinions. So he says, rather than feeling depressed by all of that and confused, it's really quite excellent because that means that things are not dogma. It's not dogmatic. And there's plenty of room for debate and discussion and working things out further and investigating. Mm-hmm. If there are different opinions that are all based on logic and so on, then you can really work with each other to see which makes the most sense. And why this and not that and so on. Whereas if it was one dogmatic thing, then you don't really develop your mind. And you have to develop the mind to understand voidness, not just memorize dogma. So I thought that was, it was nice to hear that from him. You know, even such a scholar, incredible, knowledgeable person had that experience as well. But I agree, yeah. Really makes you think and check, and this is what the Buddha said we should do. Don't just blindly believe what I say, but think about it, investigate it. So hearing about these different points of view can stimulate our investigating mind. And so anyway, let's move on. There's any questions about this? It's not a final, it's just kind of throwing more things into the cooking pot. But okay, so last time, so we're on Svatantrika, Madhyamika. And I have to say, I find this school really difficult. The last couple of days I have been reading and thinking, trying to figure out some of the things they say are quite difficult. So we got up to their mode of asserting objects, what they say about objects, and we already looked at that first bullet point, but just to review it, all phenomena exist by way of their own characteristics, exist from their own side, and exist inherently. So those are three terms that are synonymous. They all have the same meaning. And what they mean is basically, if you search for an object, a phenomenon, you will find something. Okay, so so a table, for example, they would say the table exists by way of its own characteristics. The table exists from its own side. The table exists inherently. And the meaning of that is that when you look, you search, you investigate the table, you would find something. Because they say if you didn't find something when you looked for it, then the object wouldn't exist at all. It would be non-existent. And you don't want to do that. That would be nihilism. So things have to have, this is their view, things have to have inherent existence. But they only say that conventionally. Conventionally, things exist from their own side and so on, but not ultimately. So they make that distinction. They have these three modes of existence, conventionally, but not ultimately. This is where I got stuck today. I was just like, what does that mean? How do they do that? I wrote to Venerable Children, but she didn't answer. maybe she's still figuring out. Okay, and then the last two bullet points are definitions of the two truths, which I got from cutting through appearances because they weren't in the text, the Jetson Shukyi Gelson text. But I think he would agree with them. So the definition of an ultimate truth is an object that is realized in a non-dualistic manner by a valid direct perceiver that directly realizes it. So when you have this valid direct perceiver that directly realizes it is actually talking about an Arya's meditative equipoise that is directly realizing emptiness. And so the object of that mind is emptiness, and it's realized in a non-dualistic manner, meaning there's no dualistic appearances. So the dualistic appearances that normally appear for us ordinary beings there's a few different types of dualistic appearances. The main one is appearance of true existence. That's the main dualistic appearance that's problematic. That, you know, we look at a table and the table appears truly existing, although it's not. So that's, you know, a dualistic appearance. But other kinds of dualistic appearances are just conventional truths themselves, just conventionalities like the table. And also difference in subject and object. Subject over here, looking at object over there, that's another dualistic appearance. And so those kind of appearances don't appear when the Arya is in this meditative state, directly realizing emptiness. The only thing that appears at that time is emptiness. And there's no appearance of true existence, no appearance of conventionalities or conventional truths, no appearance of difference between subject and object. So they say the mind of the Arya seems to merge with the object emptiness in a completely non-dualistic way. Must be amazing to have that experience. So anyway, the object of that kind of mind that appears in a non-dualistic way, that's the meaning of an ultimate truth. And the only thing that fits that definition is emptiness of true existence. So for this school, that's what ultimate truths are. They're emptiness of a table, emptiness of a pot, emptiness of a car, a body, whatever. And everything other than emptiness is a conventional truth. So the definition of a conventional truth is kind of the opposite. It's an object that is realized in a dualistic manner by a valid direct perceiver that directly realizes it. So a valid direct perceiver, for example, could be an eye consciousness that sees the table or that sees the wall or that sees the computer. And so that kind of mind sees in a dualistic manner. There's dualistic appearances to that kind of mind because, for example, we look at our computer. And even though the computer is empty of true existence, it appears as if it's truly existing. So there's this appearance of true existence, which in fact doesn't exist. So that's a kind of dualistic appearance. And just the appearance of conventionalities. It's a conventionality, a conventional truth. So that's another kind of dualistic appearance that's there when we have our ordinary eye consciousnesses and so on. And difference in subject and object, the sense of a mind over here looking at an object over there. So that's another dualistic appearance. So those kind of dualistic appearances occur in our ordinary experiences as ordinary beings, seeing and hearing and smelling and also thinking when we have thoughts and so on. So objects that appear to those kinds of minds in that kind of way, those are conventional truths. So a simple way of saying conventional truths are everything other than emptiness. Whatever isn't emptiness is a conventional truth.
Mm-hmm. I'm a little puzzled when they use the word realized when you define a conventional truth. It always sounds like realized really does mean getting to something non-conceptually, or, you know, they're not using apprehended or engage, you know, it just seems to be a word that's used only when you're doing things non-conceptually and directly, not...
No, the word realize, let me just look it up, because it doesn't, you know, it doesn't have this high meaning, like, you know, a high realization, but it's when we have a valid cognizer, even just seeing our computer, and if we see the computer correctly, we see it as a computer and not as something else, and later we're able to feel certain, yes, I saw that computer. And yeah, that's the meaning of realize. So it can happen with an eye consciousness, with any of the sense consciousnesses, as well as conceptual consciousnesses. So
I guess it's just using the words perceived or apprehended. I'm just, once I get like, my process.
I know. Sometimes, yeah, they use these different words, but sometimes they do say realized.
Okay.
I can find it here in my notes.
Because they don't say anything about it being mistaken. It's a valid perceiver, but it's not mistaken. The object.
So here's the meaning of realize. For a mind to realize its object means that the mind is able to lead to a correct ascertainment of the object, meaning you know it correctly, and eliminate misconceptions about it. For example, know that it's this and not that. It's a computer and not a book. So yeah, that's the meaning of that word, realize. So it can happen with
conventional objects. Okay.
Yeah, we'll get to a little later, we'll get to how this school explains what appears to eye consciousnesses, sense perceptions, and so on. It's not the same as prasangika, but that's coming a little bit later.
Okay.
We get into this whole discussion about true existence. The next slide is explaining how Svatantrika explains true existence or ultimate existence. Those two terms are synonymous. True existence, ultimate existence are the same thing. And this is their object of refutation. This is what they're refuting. This is what they say things are empty of. So all phenomena are empty of true existence. But the way they explain true existence is different than prasangika. So let's see if we can understand this. So conventionally, this is explaining how things do exist conventionally, conventional existence of things. So using a table as an example, the conventional existence of a table is dependent on two factors. First factor is the table exists inherently from its own side by way of its own characteristics. And again, the meaning of that is if you search, investigate the table, you will find something there. Because they say if you don't find something there, it wouldn't exist at all. There needs to be certain features, qualities, characteristics to be able to say it's a table. Yeah. Otherwise, you could call it a horse or a car, and it would be that. So there has to be some characteristics in the object to be able to call it a table. So that's the first factor. And the second factor is the table is posited through the force of appearing to a non-defective mind or awareness. So this term posited is, I don't know the Tibetan, I didn't look for that, but what it means here is that the table is designated by a mind to which it appears. And actually in volume 7, there's a footnote 31, explains a bit more about the meaning of this term posit. It says posit can either have the meaning of to designate, which is done by a conceptual consciousness, a conceptual mind designates, or impute, I think another term is impute, this is a table. Or it can mean to establish, which can be done by either a conceptual or a non-conceptual consciousness. So just establishing, and I think that's more the meaning here. The table is established, it's validated, verified, registered, maybe, you know? So what they say is it's not enough just to have characteristics in the object, something from the side of the object, but that has to appear to a mind, a non-defective mind, a correct mind, and be posited, which just means established, like verified, yeah, that it does exist. So what they say is both of those two factors must be present in order for something to exist. So to be able to say there is a table there, then there needs to be those two factors. Something existing from the side of the object, and then that appearing to a non-defective mind and posited. Although Geshe-ma Kelsang Wangbo didn't even use the word posited. All she said just appearing. It just has to appear to a non-defective mind. And the meaning of a non-defective mind is just a mind that that is correct about what the object is. It sees it as a table and not as a horse or something. You know? So if we looked at the table and we saw a horse, then that would be a defective mind. So if we look at a table and we see a table, then that would be a non-defective mind. And this non-defective mind could be conceptual or non-conceptual. So like even an eye consciousness, looking at the object, you know, it's not, the eye consciousness isn't saying that is a table. That's not what eye consciousness does. But eye consciousness can still recognize, can still kind of verify what an object is. So I think that's, yeah, the meaning of posited is just kind of verified, established. So that's how things exist conventionally. Then the last bullet point says the conception of true existence involves thinking that the table exists only by way of its characteristics, the first factor, without being posited by appearing to a non-defective mind, the second factor. So if you think that you don't need that second factor, you don't need, you know, a non-defective mind positing the table, but just the table existing inherently from its own side by way of its own characteristics, that's enough. That's the meaning of grasping a true existence. Does that make sense? Kind of. So Kensa Jama Tekcho says that these two factors are like two halves of a sphere. And just as both halves are necessary for it to be a sphere, a whole sphere, these two factors are needed for an object to exist, be existent. So I found that helpful, thinking in that way. It kind of makes it a little bit more accessible. Otherwise, it's quite abstract. So then the next slide.
Said through the force of appearing. The table's posited through the force of appearing.
That's just the language. I don't know.
Like, where is that force coming from?
The force. It's everywhere. I don't know why they use that. What Geshima said in her booklet, she doesn't even talk about positing. She just says the object has to appear to a non-defective mind. So that's, I think, simplifying it.
So the last point, if you don't need the second factor, is that second factor required by Prasangika's? Is that why it's split out like that?
Let's not go into that yet. We'll get to Prasangika later. Let's just try to figure out this goal.
What's the implications of them holding the first factor and not the second?
Well,
so how do you do both?
Without being posited, conception.
Conception of true existence that they're refuting.
So according to them, us ordinary beings, sentient beings, we're trapped in samsara. Why are we trapped in samsara? Because we have this ignorance that grasps at everything as truly existing. This is innate, inborn. We've had it from beginningless time. So what does that conception of true existence do? You know, what's involved in that? And so so this is their explanation of how the conception of true existence works. We look at an object like a table, and we think that the table exists completely from its own side by way of its own characteristics inherently, and it doesn't need any mind to perceive it and posit it and validate it just by itself. The table completely from its own side is enough, regardless of the mind. There's no need for the mind to, for it to appear to a mind and then be validated by that mind. So that's how things appear, according to them. That's this misconception of true existence. And they say this is wrong. This conception is wrong because even though thing like the table does have inherent existence, it does exist from its own side. It does, you know, have this way of existing. But that alone isn't enough. That mode of existence from the side of the object has to appear to a mind. There has to be a mind involved, you know, perceiving it and validating it, establishing it. So those two things together make up the conventional existence of something. Yeah. So that's how the table exists. Something from the side of the object, something from the side of the mind. Those two things coming together make the existence of the table. But if you take away the mind, the part, you know, the aspect of the mind, and even if there's no mind that sees the table and posits the table, it's still existing inherently from its own side. That's kind of, I think that's what they're saying. And so then this analogy, yeah, you can go on. This is the analogy that they use to illustrate their conception. This might help, might not, we'll see. And so I don't know if Buddha actually used this, if it comes in the sutras or not, but you probably heard this analogy before, it's not new. Anyway, this is the favorite analogy of the Svatantrikas. The Prasangika is like the rope and the snake, that one. because Futandruk is like this one. Okay, so the analogy is apparently in ancient times there were magicians who, you know, there could be just some ordinary object like a stick and or rock or anything, and they would recite a mantra or maybe abracadabra, something like that. And they also talk about some kind of salve or cream that they would put on the object. And so this combination of the salve and the mantra would cause this object to appear like something else, like an elephant or a horse. So they'd probably be in the marketplace, you know, a bunch of people around, and they do this magic trick, and suddenly there's this elephant appearing. And so then there are three different types of people who are having three different types of experience. So there's ordinary people who are in the audience, heard the mantra, and so their minds, I don't know if it affects their mind or their eyes, but anyway, somehow they are affected by the magic so that they do see an elephant, and it seems totally real. They completely believe that there's an elephant there, and they even react emotionally. They get excited or they get frightened or whatever, because it seems so real and they believe in it. And so so they say these people are like ordinary beings. Ordinary beings are those who haven't realized emptiness, who don't have a realization of emptiness. And so we see things as truly existing and completely believe in that appearance. We don't question it. We completely believe that things are truly existing just as they appear. And then we get emotionally involved. We get angry or excited or frightened or whatever, because we believe in this appearance. And the second person, the magician himself or herself, they are also affected by the magic so that the elephant appears to them as well. They see the elephant too, but they know that it's not a real elephant. They know how the magic works, and it's just a fake, a trick. So they don't get excited. They don't get emotionally caught up in the elephant. And so this represents a person who has realized emptiness inferentially, conceptually. And that's like the initial realization of emptiness. So even when you have that realization of emptiness, things still appear truly existing. You realized emptiness, and you know, when you're out of meditation, going around, looking at things, they still appear truly existent, but you know they don't exist that way because you have refuted true existence. You have realized true existence is false. So you're no longer caught up in this wrong appearance of things. And then there's a third person, a latecomer, who comes along after the magic has already happened. And so their mind isn't affected by the magic, and they don't see an elephant. So they neither see an elephant nor believe in the elephant. And so this represents an Arya in meditative equipoise, to whom only emptiness appears. Okay. They just, you know, directly realize emptiness, directly perceive emptiness. And so they don't see true existence. True existence doesn't even appear to them. So of course they don't believe in it. It doesn't appear and they don't believe in it. So this can help us understand, how ordinary beings see things, and then how once somebody has gained a realization of emptiness, then initially they start disbelieving in true existence. They don't believe in it anymore, even though it's still appearing. And finally, they get to the point where, at least during meditation, it doesn't even appear. it's no longer even an appearance of true existence. And I thought I was gonna, so I was thinking that this is just my own idea, but I think that this analogy can also illustrate those two factors in the previous slide. The first factor, an object having existence from its own side, and then the mind positing it. So I think that we could say that the stick that was, you know, caused to appear like an elephant, that could represent the first factor, because there has to be something there. I think, you know, for this kind of magic show to happen, there's got to be a basis. I don't think the magician can just cause an elephant to appear out of nowhere, but there's some basis they use, like a stick or a rock. They put the salve and they say the mantra, and then poof, it appears like something else. So there's got to be a basis there. So I was thinking that, yeah, the stick may be like the first factor, that there is something there in the object. And then for the second factor, I thought this would be the minds of the audience, the people in the audience. So their minds that have been affected by the magic of the magician. Because if there were no minds, I mean, if the magician was just out in an empty field, no people around to, you know, to do this magic on, then, you know, they wouldn't have the appearance. There would be no mind seeing an elephant. So there also has to be a mind there that's affected so that it sees an elephant. Mm-hmm. So I thought the minds of the people in the audience would be like this, the second factor. There are minds that are non-defective, although we would have to say, well, they were kind of defective in the analogy, but they were deceived by the magic. I don't know, this is just an idea that I have that might help us understand better. So both factors are needed. There has to be something out there, and there has to be minds to see that thing out there. When those two factors come together, then there can be this illusory appearance of an elephant that's in the magic show. And in a similar way, like a table, there does have to be a table there that has certain characteristics from its own side. And then there needs to be minds to which that appears, and they posit it or they validate it. So those two things have to come together for the table to exist conventionally, conventional existence of the table. I don't know. Like I say, I'm still struggling with photography. Thinking in that way helped me. And then the last point on the slide says, according to Svatantrika, true existence doesn't appear to sense perception, it only appears to conception. Because you may have heard with Prasangika, according to Prasangika, they say that true existence does appear to all of our minds, so our sense perceptions and our conceptions. So everything we see and hear and smell and taste and touch and think about, all things appear truly existing, inherently existing. So it appears to all of our minds, all of our experiences. However, Svatantrika is different. So they say that true existence only appears to our conceptual minds, but not to our sense perceptions. But they do say that inherent existence appears to our perceptions. So when we look at something, it does appear inherently existing, but according to them, that's correct. Things do exist inherently. So that it's not a mistake. It's not a mistake to see things as inherently existing. Whereas, according to Prasangika, what would they say?
Erroneous. Is it mistaken?
It's mistake. Yeah. So both Svatantrika and Prasangika agree that when we see an object, it appears inherently existing. They both agree about that. However, Svatantrika would say, that's fine, it does exist inherently. Whereas Prasangika would say, no, it's not fine, it doesn't exist that way. Yeah. It's complicated, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Kind of mind bending too. It's like, but yeah, it is important. I mean, we might think, can't we just skip over this and go to the Prasangikas? But they say too, yeah, we do need to understand all the other schools to be able to understand Prasangika, even though sometimes Prasangika doesn't seem that difficult, it seems simpler. But we probably don't really understand it. Now, we do have to understand what the other schools are saying to be able to understand Prasangika. So anyway, I was just trying to explain how this school explains true existence, but it's not easy.
Would the Svatantrika say that conventional existence is illusory?
Would they say that it's illusory? Well, I think they would talk about illusory in the sense that, things do appear when we, the things that we experience, not to our, they don't appear truly existent to our sense perceptions, but to our conceptions, they do. So I guess what that means is, we first see the table and very quickly start having conceptions about it, thinking it's a table, it's this, it's that, it was made by Venerable Yeshe, it's beautiful, it's ugly, whatever, all these kind of thoughts. So when we're having thoughts about the object, at that time, there's this false appearance of the object as truly existing. So we're thinking about a truly existing table, even though, in fact, there's no such thing as a truly existing table. So our thoughts about the object are based on mistake, based on seeing things incorrectly. So they do talk about illusion in that sense that, yeah, that's an illusion. It's an illusion to think that things are truly existing when they are not. And so they do talk about like when a yogi has realized emptiness, and after they realize emptiness, they see things and things still appear truly existing, but the yogi knows they don't exist that way. That's a false appearance. So there is a sense of illusion, dream, like an illusion, like a mirage. Yeah, so they have all those same kind of analogies like Prasangika. Mm-hmm. They're still hanging on to something. There's got to be something there in the object. They don't want to let go of that. They're afraid that they would fall into nihilism if they let go of things existing inherently. Okay, so there's a little bit more about objects. These are just from the text, Jetsun Shuki Gelson's text. The first one says, non-compounded space, true cessations, past, future, and subtle selflessness of persons are all non-affirming negatives as well as conventional truths. So these are examples of permanent phenomena, according to this school. This school would say these are all permanent phenomena, but they are not emptinesses of true existence. And so they are conventional truths. They're not ultimate truths. So that makes it clear that only emptiness of true existence is an ultimate truth, and even like selflessness of persons is still a conventional truth. And all these things are also non-affirming negatives. We learned about that before. That's when there's some kind of refutation. Something is refuted or negated, nothing affirmed in its place. So I was interested in past and future. Why are those non-affirming negatives? So Geshe Jama Tekchok, in his commentary, he said, past is the fact that a present function has happened and has receded into the past. So there was something there at one point in time, it was present, but then it slipped into the past right away. You know, one moment later, it becomes the past. And so it appears to our mind as an absence of the past thing in the present time. It appears to our mind as the absence of a past thing in the present time. So I was thinking of an example relevant to what's happening now. The existence of legal abortions, at least in some places, the existence of legal abortions. At one point in time, abortions were legal in certain places. And now, just in the last couple of days, legal abortions have become a thing of the past, right? It's a past phenomenon, no longer present in the present time. So that's how it's a non-affirming negative. Something has been refuted or negated, nothing in its place. And then future, he said, the future is the fact that a phenomenon is yet to come into existence. When the future appears to our mind, it does so as the absence of the future thing existing in the present time. So I was thinking of an example of that, my death. It's still future. It's not yet present. It could be present in the next moment, but at this moment, it's still future. It hasn't happened yet. So I guess when that appears to our mind, when we think about our death, it appears as the absence of that in the present. That is not existing in the present. It's absent in the present. Something like that. Interesting idea. So the present existence of these objects, like legal abortions in Mississippi, or my death at this moment in time, so the present existence of these objects is negated, and nothing is affirmed in their place. So that's how they are non-affirming negatives. Now, this might be mentioned here because Prasangika has a different explanation we'll get to later. They say that past and future are, or at least past, I'm not sure future, we'll get to that later, but past is an impermanent phenomena. It's impermanent, something impermanent. I think that's when we get into this. What's that term?
Oh, having ceased.
Yeah. I always have trouble with that one. Yeah, but Prasangik is kind of unique compared to the other schools. All the other schools say that past is permanent, a permanent phenomenon. It's a non-functioning thing. It can't function. It can't perform a function. It's just, yeah. But it's one of the unique assertions of the Prasangika. Then the next bullet point says, ultimate truth, reality, and subtle selflessness of phenomena are all mutually inclusive. These are synonyms. So ultimate truth, which is emptiness of true existence. Reality is another term for that. And subtle selflessness of phenomena. These are all different terms for the same thing. Let's see if we can just finish this. Okay, then SSM, so Trantika Svatantrika, say that the five sense objects are different entities from consciousness and are gross external objects made of partless particles. So that's, you know, this saying that they assert external objects. The table, when we see the table, it isn't just something coming from a seed or imprint in our mind. It is out there. And so it's not the same entity or nature as the mind that perceives it. And it's made of partless particles. So the meaning of a partless particle, we learned about this with Vaibhashika. It means it's a very, very, very tiny particle. It can't be divided further. And I guess you can't even talk about different sides. I don't know if they really get into that or not. It's hard to believe that Svatantrikas would agree with that, but because the Chittamatrans say, that doesn't make sense. You know, if you say there's a part, if there are particles that don't have sides, an eastern side, a western side, a top and a bottom, then how can they touch each other? How can they come together and amass and make larger objects? They have to have parts, at least directionally, parts. So the Chittamatra pointed that one out. And but then the Yogacara Svatantrika Madhyamika say that the five sense objects are one entity with the consciousness apprehending them. This shows they're refuting external objects. The table isn't out there separate from the mind, waiting for us to come along and see it, but it's the table we see arises from our mind, simultaneous with the eye consciousness that's perceiving it. So they are one entity. The object and the mind perceiving it are one entity. My guess is they would refute partless particles, just like the Chittamatra. So it's probably enough for today. That's the end of the section on objects, and then next is getting into object possessors. The rest of the material in this school isn't so difficult. It's the thing that's really difficult is how they explain true existence. So if you have volume 7, you know, there is a section in here. It's not very extensive, but goes through the different schools and a little bit about each school and how they explain, mainly how they explain the two truths and what exists and what doesn't exist. So you might find that helpful to read. Any questions before we finish? Let's dedicate the merit we've created.
Due to this merit, may we soon attain the awakened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind not yet born arise and grow. May that born have no decline, but increase forevermore.